is on the table. But the hum of a vacuum cleaner sounded from somewhere deep inside the house, and Hal followed the sound along a tiled corridor lined with stuffed birds of prey, poised beneath dusty glass, and through a room laid for breakfast. There were boxes of cereal, a tub of margarine, and a bag of cheap sliced bread laid out next to an ancient toaster. Beyond that was a conservatory full of grapevines and orange trees, or at least it had been at one time. There were no orange trees left, but the labels on the pots still bore their names. Caracara, Valencia, Moro. A few vines remained, their thick, gnarled stems rising from the ground, but they had almost all died. The leaves were yellowed, and a few bunches of raisin-like grapes clung to the stalks. The only living thing was the thin strands of grass that clung tenaciously between the bricks of the floor. It was very cold, a chilly draught blowing from somewhere and making the withered leaves on the dead vines flutter and rustle. And looking up, Hal saw that one of the panes in the roof had smashed, and the wind was blowing through. The vacuum cleaner was loud now, and coming from the room the other side of the conservatory, so Hal pushed through the dead vines and opened the door at the far end. The room was some kind of sitting room, very dark and furnished with a Victorian level of clutter, all tasseled curtains and side tables and overstuffed sofas. In the middle of the room, standing on the hearthrug, was Mrs. Warren, her stick laid to one side, pushing the hoover back and forth with grim determination. For a moment, Hal thought about retreating, but then she reconsidered. She still needed information on Maud, and this might prove the perfect opportunity. A quiet interlude, one-on-one. It would be much easier to control the conversation, bring it round to what she wanted to know. And she could use Mrs. Warren's age and slight deafness to her advantage. Old ladies usually loved to reminisce, and it would be easy to cover any slips by pretending Mrs. Warren had misheard what she had said. Hal coughed, but the housekeeper did not hear her over the sound of the motor, and at last she cleared her throat and spoke.
"Hello? Hello, Mrs. Warren?"
The old lady swung round, the hoover still going, and then switched it off.
"What are you doing here?"
Her expression was accusing. Hal felt herself quail a little in spite of herself.
I'm sorry. I heard the hoover and I..."
"This is my sitting room. Private, you see."
"I didn't know."
A mixture of defensiveness and annoyance rose up inside her.
"I'm sorry, but I couldn't have known it."
"You should have known,"
the old lady snapped. She clicked the hoover back into its upright position and picked up her stick.
"Coming here, swanning around like you owned the place."
"I wasn't,"
Hal said, goaded out of politeness.
"I wouldn't do that at all. I just didn't know."
"You ask. Do you hear me? You don't go poking into things that don't concern you."
Mrs. Warren stopped and glared at Hal with undisguised hostility.
"Look, I said I'm sorry," Hal said.
She crossed her arms protectively across her chest, nettled by the injustice of it, and yet unable to defend herself, because she could not afford to antagonize someone she might need to mine for information. Besides, at bottom, the old lady was right. She was an intruder, however much she might pretend otherwise.
"I'll go back to the other wing. A sudden inspiration came. I was just going to ask if you needed any help."
She smiled, pleased with her own quick-wittedness, but it faded from her lips as she saw Mrs. Warren draw herself up to her not very full height, her expression venomous.
"Well, aren't we the gracious little lady? I may be getting on, but I'm not quite in my dotage, and I don't need help from the likes of you."
Mrs. Warren said. She managed to make the final word sound like an insult.
Breakfast will be at 8.
And she turned and switched on the Hoover again. Hal retreated quietly, closing the door behind her, and went back into the conservatory, feeling ruffled by the encounter. How could Mrs. Warren have taken her last word so personally? It was like she had wanted to take offence. Aren't we the gracious little lady? The implication stung, the more so because it was so untrue. If it had been Richard or Kitty at the door, then she could have understood at least. But Hal's upbringing had been about as far from being born with a silver spoon as you could possibly get. She thought of her own childhood, pushing that ancient, coughing Hoover around the living room after school, before her mother got home from the pier, wanting to take some of the load off where she could. The second-hand clothes her mother had picked over at the charity shops. The boys' shoes she had been forced to wear when there were no girls' ones in her sizes. "You know what?" her mother had said, pleading with Hal with her eyes to like them. "I think they're cooler anyway. They suit you." And Hal had smiled and nodded and worn them with as much pride as she could muster.
"I prefer them," she'd told the girls at school. "They're better for running and jumping and playing football."
It had come to be true in the end.
"You know nothing about me," she wanted to shout back through the sitting room door.
She walked back slowly through the conservatory, wondering what to do until the others came down. Outside, she could see, dimly, through the green mould on the panes, the lawn stretching down to the sea, and beyond it the wind-swept yews, the ones furthest from the house half bent over by the continual sea wind. The magpies were strutting on the lawn, and Hal thought of the rhyme that Mr. Treswick had recited yesterday. She couldn't make out the number of birds through the clouded glass, but there must be at least 7, maybe more, and it seemed suddenly right in this house full of secrets. Well, it was very plain she wasn't going to get any answers from Mrs. Warren. The Hoover was still humming from behind the sitting room door, but Hal no longer had any faith in her ability to plumb the housekeeper for information, even when she emerged. And the rest of the house was quiet. But perhaps she could use this interlude to her advantage. Stepping softly, she opened the 3rd door leading out from the conservatory. It led into a small hallway, with a toilet opening off one side of it, the cistern dripping hollowly, and on the other side of it a door firmly closed. Hal glanced behind her, thinking of Mrs. Warren's accusations of poking and prying, but the vacuum cleaner was still going, and with a defiant spurt of adrenaline she reached out and turned the handle. She slipped inside and closed the door behind her as quietly as she could. It was a study, but one that had plainly not been used in many years. Dust was thick on the books, cobwebs skeined across the desk blotter, and the telephone that rested on the desk was yellowed Bakelite of the kind Hal had only seen in films. There was a cracked leather book on the desk embossed with the words, "Diary Planner," in faded gilt lettering. And very, very gently, Hal opened the cover. "Desk, Diary and Day Planner, 1979, she read. It was older than Hal herself. When she let the cover fall back, it made a sound like a soft thud, and a little cloud of dust rose up. Whose room had this been? It was profoundly masculine in a way Hal couldn't quite define, and she could not imagine Mrs. Westaway using it somehow. Was it Mr. Westaway's? What had happened to him? She leafed through the desk diary for a few pages, hoping something useful might leap out at her. Maud's birthday seemed too good to hope for, but there might be some nugget of information she could use to her advantage. but the writing was so crabbed it was hard to make anything out, and those notes she did decipher were resolutely unpromising and businesslike. CF meeting, telephone Weber, 12:30 Mr. Woburn, Barclays. Hal closed it gently and turned her attention to the rest of the study. Opposite the desk were shelves of books, rising to the ceiling, as dusty and cobwebbed as everything else. All except, Hal suddenly noticed, for one volume, tucked away at the far top right, a slim, anonymous book with a buttercup yellow spine. Beneath it was a set of wooden steps designed for reaching the top shelves, and looking closer, Hal could see that there was a footprint in the dust. Still dusty itself, to be sure, but not the 30 years of dust covering the rest of the study. Hal cocked her head, listening to the vacuum cleaner going back and forth, and then climbed up the steps to retrieve the book, trying to set her feet as closely as possible within the prints of the other person. It was a photograph album. She could tell that as soon as she took it down. As she opened it, the thick pages creaked gently, the plastic film that covered the pictures unsticking with reluctance. The first page held a black-and-white snapshot of a fat blonde baby in an old-fashioned pram and a miniature Aran sweater, staring blurrily out to the camera. There was a lawn behind him, falling away to the sea, and Hal recognised the view as the top terrace at Trepassen, just outside the drawing room. Harding, 1965, was written in neat pencil across one corner. Hal turned the pages, feeling like a time traveller tiptoeing through the past. There was a little boy, aged about 2, on the beach below the house, and another of him sat on the lap of a stiff, formal-looking man with a bristly moustache. The boy was presumably Harding, but who was the man? Mr. Westaway? More photographs. A colour snap of the same little boy, a little older this time, on a blue tricycle. H, June 1969, read the caption. Next came Harding in school uniform, knock-kneed in his grey shorts, and then another baby appeared, red-faced and newborn. Maud? For a second, Hal felt her heart leap as she looked to the pencilled caption beneath for a date. But no. It read, Abel Leonard, born the 13th of March, 1972. On the facing page was a black-and-white picture of the same baby lying on a hearthrug, kicking his little legs. A.L. 3 months, said the caption. But before she could turn the page, a noise made her freeze. There were voices filtering in through the hallway. Not Mrs. Warren, by the sound of it, but members of the family. And they were coming closer. She must not be found in here, poking through the family papers. Hastily, Hal shoved the book back into place and scrambled back down the ladder, less careful this time about where she put her feet, and then stood at the bottom, holding her breath as she tried to work out where the voices were coming from. At first her heart was thudding too much to make it out. Then she heard, Mrs. Warren, how might one obtain some coffee? And realised they were coming from the breakfast room. Quickly, Hal slipped out of the study, closing the door behind her, and hurried through the little hallway. She was just in time. No sooner had she entered the conservatory than the door to the breakfast room opened, and Harding's head stuck out. Mrs. He broke off.
Oh, Harriet.
Yes, Hal said, slightly breathlessly. There was dust on her fingers, she saw, from the study, and she wiped them surreptitiously on the back of her jeans.
I was just passing the time in here until 8. Mrs. Warren said breakfast would be served then.
Well, you'd better come through,
Harding said. There was something awkward in his manner, and he coughed and picked an imaginary speck of dust off his blue golfing pullover before adding,
About last night, Harriet. Naturally the news was a shock, but I hope you didn't.
Please, Hal managed. She felt a betraying flush rise up her cheeks. There's no need. But Harding was going to say his piece no matter what, and Hal had no choice but to stand and endure a rather pompous little speech that basically amounted to an apology for his remarks last night.
"That's not to say," he finished up, "that I don't still have some concerns about Mother's state of mind, but I was wrong, very wrong, to suggest that that was any reflection on you, Harriet. If you have any involvement in this at all, it's as an innocent bystander." "Well, there we go,"
he coughed and brushed at his sweater again.
"Passing on to more pleasant things, I hope you're feeling better?"
Oh, yes, Hal said, though her cheeks were still flushed. "Thank you, I feel completely fine. I'll be able to travel today."
"Travel today?"
Harding raised his eyebrows.
"There's no question of that, my dear. Mr. Tresick needs to see all the beneficiaries in his office in Penzance, and in any case, there's a great deal we need to sort out here."
At the mention of the appointment with the lawyer, Hal felt her stomach lurch as sickeningly as if the ground had dropped away beneath her feet. Of course she had known that there would be hoops and formalities, but somehow in her fantasies about how this would pan out, she had always imagined herself sending in her documents by post from a safe remove. That was before, though, when she had been imagining a legacy of a few thousand at most. Now, with the entire estate hinging on her identity, the prospect of having to go in person and actually stand there, heart thumping, while her papers were looked over was not comforting. There would probably be questions, too, specific ones that Harding, Abel, and Ezra had been too polite to put to her at their mother's wake, and she would have no time to figure out plausible answers or pick her wording. What if Mr. Tresick realized his mistake while she was actually in his office? Would he call the police? She opened her mouth to reply, but before she could find the right words, the door behind them slammed open, and Mrs. Warren appeared, stick in hand.
"Oh, Mrs. Warren,"
Harding said with an ingratiating smile.
"We were just discussing breakfast. How kind of you to put out the toaster and so on. Where can one obtain tea and coffee?"
"It's not yet 8,
Mrs. Warren said stonily. Harding blinked, and Hal could tell he was doing his best not to look put out.
"Well, I appreciate that, but it's 7:55.
"What Harding means,"
came a voice from behind them, and Hal turned to see Ezra standing in the doorway. He was unshaven and looked almost hungover, his clothes rumpled and his hair standing up on end. But as Hal watched, his mouth quirked into the most charmingly wry smile she could remember encountering, transforming his whole expression.
"What he meant to say is, couldn't we persuade you, Mrs. Warren, to let us take some of the work off your hands and see to our own tea?"
"Well," Mrs. Warren said. She smoothed her hair with her free hand.
"I don't know about that, Mr. Ezra."
Her Cornish burr sounded suddenly stronger.
"My kitchen is my kitchen, but I'll see what I can do."
She turned and disappeared back through the door at the end of the conservatory, and Ezra winked at Hal.
"Harriet, good to see you vertical. That was quite a performance you put in last night."
Hal felt herself flush. Quite a performance. The reference was clearly to her fainting fit, but the word was uncomfortably close to the truth. "I'm feeling much better."
"Unusual to see you vertical at this hour, if it comes to that,"
Harding said sourly.
"I'm very fortunate for you and your morning tea that I am, Harding. What's the saying? Something about flies and honey?"
"Flies be damned. She's a cantankerous old bat." I don't know why Mother put up with her all these years. I notice she's walked away with her 30,000 intact.
That's hardly the point, Ezra said. His smile had disappeared, and he looked at Harding with something pretty close to naked dislike.
Then lower your voice, unless you want to have cold soup for the rest of the stay. What do you mean it's hardly the point? I mean she was basically a carer to Mother for about 15 years for a peppercorn wage. You think we could have got a live-in nurse for the kind of money Mother paid Mrs. Warren? 30,000 seems like a pretty cheap price to pay to me. It's pretty rich to say we could have got a nurse,
Harding said irritably.
I can't see what you would know about the matter, given we haven't seen you on these shores for the best part of 20 years. At least Abel had an excuse for cutting and running. Those of us who stuck around to see through our responsibilities, you always were a sanctimonious shit,
Ezra said. He grinned, making a joke of the words, but there was no charm or humour in his expression this time, more the quality of a wolf baring its teeth. Hal held her breath, unsure of where this was going, but Harding didn't reply. Instead, he simply rolled his eyes and turned away from his brother towards the breakfast room. When he got to the door, he held it open for Hal, standing punctiliously back until she had passed through. Inside, Mitzi, Richard, and the two other children were seated at the end of the long table. Abel and Edward were nowhere to be seen.
"Harriet, darling," Mitzi said.
She had put on lipstick this morning, and her mouth was incongruously cheerful against the muted, faded shades of the room and the bleached morning light.
"How are you feeling today?"
"Fine, thank you, Mitzi," Hal said. She took the seat that Harding pulled out for her between himself and Ezra and sat down. "I'm not sure what happened last night. A mixture of cold and no food, I think."
"Not to mention the shock," Mitzi said.
She pursed her lips disapprovingly as she reached for the muesli.
"I don't know what Mr. Treswick was thinking, springing the whole will situation on us like that."
"Well, he had to tell us at some point,"
Ezra said. He seemed to have recovered from his flash of irritation with Harding. The smile was back in place and more convincing now.
"He probably thought it was better to rip the plaster off in one go, so to speak. Get it over with."
"He should have prepared us," Mitzi said stubbornly. "Particularly poor Harding."
"Why poor Harding?"
Ezra asked. He grinned across the table at Mitzi.
"The rest of us are just as snubbed as him, you know. Or is it that much of a shock to be lumped in with us povos?"
"Ezra,"
Mitzi said with the air of someone having their patience tested, "you haven't been here, but Harding was certainly led to expect."
"Tough when you've already put down the deposit on a new Land Rover,"
Ezra said sympathetically.
"Now look here,"
Harding said at the same time as Mitzi snapped,
"Ezra, you are being deliberately provocative."
Ezra only laughed, throwing back his head so that Hal could see the unshaven line of his jaw and the hollow of his collarbone where his shirt was open at the neck. Then he stood, threw down his napkin and stretched until his shirt tails came loose.
"Fuck it,"
he said laconically, leaning across the table and picking up the piece of toast Richard was buttering on his plate.
"This is a little more hypocrisy than I can cope with at breakfast. I'm going out."
"Out where?"
Mitzi demanded, but Ezra didn't seem to have heard her question. He took a giant bite of Richard's toast, tossed the crust onto the table, and then strode out into the hall.
"He's impossible!"
Mitzi exploded as the door slammed behind him.
"Harding, are you going to let him get away with that?"
"Damn it, Mitt," What do you want me to do?
Harding pushed away his plate.
Anyway, he's right.
What do you mean? He stole Richard's toast, and how dare he accuse you of hypocrisy?
Oh, for God's sake!
Harding stood, marched over to the toaster, and shoved in two more slices of bread.
Happy? The toast is hardly the most important thing here.
Accusing you of hypocrisy, then? What cheek!
I think that was a general remark, Mitt. And much as I find him deeply irritating, he's not wrong on that particular point, is he? All of us in that church yesterday with our carefully glum faces, and I doubt there was one person there who was sorry she was gone.
How dare you!
The voice came from the doorway, and all the heads at the table turned to see Mrs. Warren standing in the doorway, a coffee jug trembling in one hand.
How dare you, you little snivelling good-for-note!
Mrs. Warren,
Harding said stiffly. He drew himself up to his full height.
What I said was intended for my wife, and in any case...
Don't you Mrs. Warren me, you despicable little arsehole!
She snarled, her Cornish accent somehow making the last word into a kind of foreign invective.
Mrs.
Harding began, but he didn't get to finish. Mrs. Warren set down the coffee pot on the table with a crack that sent drops spattering across their plates and slapped him around the back of the head like a recalcitrant child. Hal's face felt frozen. The whole scene was surreal. Harding standing there like a pompous schoolboy caught swearing in the corridor, Mrs. Warren, her face twisted with fury, Mitzi, Richard and the other children wide-eyed with shock.
Mrs. Warren!
Harding bellowed furiously, rubbing the back of his head, and at the same time Harding's daughter called out,
Daddy!
And then, when her father did not respond more urgently,
Daddy, the toast!
They all turned to look at the ancient toaster on the end of the table to see smoke pouring out of the opening at the top. As Hal watched in horror, the blackened slice burst into flames.
That goddamn thing! Harding roared. It's a death trap! Mother should have thrown it away years ago!
He marched across to the wall socket, pulled out the plug, and then threw a placemat over the smoking toaster. The flames went out. A strong smell of singed cotton joined the scent of burnt toast, and Mitzi let out a shuddering breath.
Oh, for heaven's sakes! Is there nothing reliable in this house? Mrs. Warren, can you...
But then she stopped, breaking off in exasperation. Mrs. Warren had gone. Chapter 18. The rest of the breakfast had a stifled, edgy quality, as if no one wanted to refer to Mrs. Warren's outburst and Ezra's disappearance, and although she knew she should have been using the time to winkle out vital facts about Maud before her interview with Mr. Trezick, Hal found herself bolting down her toast and then excusing herself from the table as fast as possible. In the hall, she paused for a moment, trying to decide what to do. She had no desire to go back up to that coffin-like bedroom, but wandering around the house like she already owned the place felt painfully presumptuous. She needed to get out, clear her head, try to work out her next move. Further up the corridor, she could see a door to the garden standing open, presumably where Ezra had made his exit, and she followed the stiff breeze and crunched her way out onto the gravel at the front of the house. Ahead of her was a wide sweep of drive, dotted with weeds and self-seeded saplings. To the left was a block of low buildings, garages, or perhaps former stables, she thought. but the smell of cigarette smoke filtering round the corner told her that that was where Ezra had gone, and she had no desire to face him just now. In fact, she needed a break from them all. Instead, she turned right, walking past a rather dismal shrubbery with a strong scent of cats, and round to the facade she had seen on that postcard. The long, low house, the lawn falling away to the sea. We had a very good tea at Trepassen House. What had happened to that house and that family? The picture postcard tranquillity she had seen in that photograph, tea on the lawn like something from an Agatha Christie novel, all that had vanished, swallowed up in decay and something stranger and more worrying. It was not just the sense she had of a house long neglected. It was something darker. The feeling of a place hiding secrets, where people had been terribly unhappy and no one had come to comfort them. Wrapped in her thoughts, Hal crunched across the frosted lawn, feeling the frozen blades of grass crackle beneath her boots. The air was crisp and cold, and she huffed out, watching her white breath disappear. When she stopped to look back at the house, she realized how far she had come and how large the grounds really were. From her attic room, it had been hard to see where the garden ended and the surrounding countryside began. But now she had walked almost to the copse at the bottom of the lawn. She was a good couple of hundred yards from the house, and she could see that the copse itself formed part of the grounds, a cluster of trees with something at the centre. Hal thought she could see something dark glinting through the trees. Could it be water?
"Admiring your domain?"
The voice coming from behind her up the slope made Hal jump, and she jerked her head round to see Abel walking down the lawn, his hands in his pockets.
"No!"
The word slipped defensively out before Hal had properly considered her reply, and she felt her cheeks flush with something that was not just cold. But Abel only laughed. He pulled at his moustache.
"I'm not Harding. You don't need to worry about me on that score. There's no ill feeling on my part, I assure you. I had no expectations anyway."
Hal wrapped her arms around herself, unsure what to say. It struck her that for someone who kept stressing how very unconcerned he was about being cut off, Abel talked about it a lot. She remembered Mitzi's words in the library.
"Oh, Abel, stop being such a saint!"
Was anyone really that selfless? Could someone survive being disinherited by their only parent and honestly feel no bitterness at all? Abel seemed to feel her equivocation, or at least her discomfort about the topic, for he changed the subject.
"But tell me, what happened at breakfast?"
"At breakfast?" Hal faltered. She remembered Harding and Ezra's near fight, and felt herself hedging, unwilling to get caught in the complicated web of resentments and loyalties she sensed between the brothers.
I'm not sure what you mean."
"Harding and Ezra had, well, a bit of a disagreement."
"Oh, you needn't worry about them,"
Abel said with a laugh. He fell into step beside her.
"They've been sparring since Ezra could first talk. By the way, if we head to the left here, I can show you the maze."
"There's a maze?"
"Not a very good one. It's over there."
He pointed away from the copse of trees towards the far side of the lawn.
"But that wasn't what I meant, actually. I was talking about the plumes of smoke floating up the stairs."
"Oh, that," Hal said. She echoed his laugh, relieved to be on less touchy ground. "The toaster caught fire."
"Oh, was that it? I thought perhaps Mrs. Warren had tried to burn the house down, rather than let it pass to the unworthy."
Hal felt her cheeks flush in sudden shock at the word, and Abel's face changed. Oh, God. Harriet, I'm sorry. That was incredibly crass of me. I didn't mean you. I just meant... Well, look. Mrs. Warren's always had a touch of the Mrs. Danvers about her. I don't think she would have been happy with any of us inheriting, except maybe Ezra.
It's okay, Hal said stiffly. She could hardly admit how close to the bone Abel's remark had struck.
Why does she like Ezra so much?
She managed, after a moment's awkward silence. Abel blew into his hands, sending a cloud of white breath gusting ahead of them as if thinking about her question.
Who knows? He said at last. There's no reason, on paper at least. He's always been charming, but heaven knows Mrs. Warren is pretty resistant to stuff like that. He was always Mother's favourite, too. Youngest child syndrome, maybe. Youngest boy, at least. Your mother was actually the youngest, of course, by a few hours, anyway.
There were twins, Hal said unguardedly, and then wanted to bite her tongue off. She had to stop saying the first thing that came into her head. She had never thought of herself as a particularly garrulous person, quite the reverse, in fact. People who knew her often remarked on how self-contained she was, how little she volunteered. But she had not understood before coming here how impossible any conversation at all would be, how every chance remark could be a trap. It wasn't just a case of not giving away too much of herself and concealing the gaps in her knowledge. Every step she took was on false ground that could give way at any moment. She could not afford to forget that. Fortunately, though, Abel didn't seem to have noticed the oddness of her question. He only nodded.
Fraternal, of course. They were very close. I was 4 years older, and Harding older still. He's 8 years older than me, so he was away at school by the time they could walk. But Maud and Ezra... That's why I think he never really got over her disappearance. He was always a tempestuous personality, but after she ran away... I don't know, Harriet. Something changed. It was like all that fire turned inwards onto himself. He spent years looking for her, you know.
I'm so sorry, Hal said. Her throat was stiff and sore with falsehood.
Abel put a gentle hand on her shoulder. She felt as if his touch should have burned her, but it did not.
She was a remarkable woman, he said softly. I don't know how much she told you about her childhood, but it can't have been easy being here with Mother after Harding and I had broken away. Ezra was at boarding school for most of the time, and even when he was at home, he somehow always managed to escape the worst of it, but... Well, my mother wasn't an easy person to cope with at the best of times, and she got stranger and more irascible as she got older. I think, in the end, Mrs. Warren was really the only person who could stand to be in her company, and I'm not sure she really got away unscathed. But listen.
He stopped, cleared his throat, and drew a breath, then smiled determinedly.
The reason I came to find you, I found something in my room, and I thought you... Well, I thought you might like it.
They had stopped walking, and Abel reached in his pocket and pulled out a crumpled photograph, folded and dog-eared and yellowed with that strange golden haze that always seems to come over photographs a few decades old.
I'm sorry it's not in very good condition, but, well, you'll see.
Hal took the piece of paper from Abel and bent over it, trying to make it out. When she did... Her breath caught in her throat, and she almost choked.
Harriet,
Abel said uncertainly. I'm sorry, maybe this isn't... But Hal couldn't speak. She could only stare at the photograph in her hand, pressing her fingers together so that their shaking couldn't betray her shock. For there, on the lawn outside Trepassen House, was a little group of four people. Two girls, a boy, and a slightly older man in his early 20s. The man was Abel, his honey-coloured hair cut into a painfully 90s Britpop crop, and his clothes very far from the expensively cut outfit he was wearing today, but unmistakably him. The boy was Ezra, his black hair and curving smile making him instantly recognisable, and sitting next to him was a fair-haired girl wearing battered Doc Martens laughing at him. She must be his long-lost twin sister, the missing Maud. But the fourth member of the group, the last girl, sitting on her own a little way from the others, her dark eyes looking directly at the camera and at the person taking the photograph, that girl was Hal's mother. Hal found she was not breathing, and she made herself inhale long and slow and let it out again, trying not to let her trembling breath give away how badly shocked she was. Her mother had been here. But when? How?
Harriet, Abel said at last, are you okay?
I'm sorry. It must still be very raw for you. Yes, Hal managed, though her voice was a whisper of its usual self. She swallowed and forced herself to hold the photograph out towards Abel. Abel, there's you, Ezra, and my mother, but... She swallowed again, trying hard to work out how to phrase this, how to ask the question she needed to know without giving everything away. Who's the other girl?
Maggie.
Abel took the photograph from her fingers and smiled fondly at the little group, forever seated in the sunshine, frozen in their teens and twenties, forever young.
Goodness, little Maggie Westaway. I'd almost forgotten about her. She was, well, I suppose a sort of distant cousin. Her real name was Margarita too, I believe, like Maud, though we never called either of them that. Too much of a mouthful. She used to call Mother her aunt, but I think, in fact, her father was my father's nephew or cousin, something of that kind. Her parents died when she was in her teens, a lot like you, Hal, and she came here to finish her final year at school. Poor thing. I don't think it was a very happy time for her.
Hal looked at the girl sitting on the grass, at her unflinching dark eyes, and she saw what Abel meant. There was something wary and equivocal in the girl's gaze. She was the only member of the little group who was not smiling. I see, Hal managed. She tried to steady the trembling in her legs and keep her muscles from betraying her. Thank you for sharing this with me. It means a lot.
It's for you,
Abel said. He held out the picture, and Hal took it wonderingly. She let her finger trace over her mother's face. Really? Are you sure?
Yes, of course. I don't need it. I have enough memories of that time, and they're not all of them very good ones. But this was a lovely day. I remember we all went swimming in the lake. It was before... Well, never mind, but I'd like you to have it.
Thank you, Hal said. She folded the photograph carefully along the existing line and pushed it gently into her pocket. Then she remembered her manners and made herself smile. Thank you, Abel. I'll treasure it. And she turned and walked away up the frozen slope towards the house, unable to keep up the pretense any longer. As Hal hurried up the stairs towards the attic, she could feel the shape of the photograph in her jeans pocket, and she had to stop herself from putting her hand over it, as if to hide it from sight. Her mother. Dear God. Her mother. Hal was panting as she climbed the last set of steps to the attic bedroom, and inside she shut the door, pulled the photograph out of her pocket, and sank to the floor with her back against the door, staring at the little image. It all made sense. The coincidence over the names, Mr. Treswick's mistake. The only strange thing was that Abel himself hadn't guessed the truth on seeing the photo. For it was so painfully clear now Hal had the evidence in front of her own eyes. Maggie, Abel had called her mother. Hal herself had never heard her mother use the nickname, but it was an obvious shortening for Margarita. A family name, her mother had said once when she'd asked why her grandparents had chosen such an odd, hard-to-spell name. And then she had shut down the conversation, as she often did when Hal wanted her to talk about her childhood and her long-dead parents. Her real name was Margarita, too, like Maud. Two cousins, both called Margarita Westaway. And in looking for one, Mr. Treswick had stumbled upon the other without realizing. Had he even known of the other Margarita's existence? Presumably not, or he would have made sure to find the right person when he searched. But if all he had was a name, and an unusual name at that, if you found Joan Smith, you would make damn sure you'd found the right one. But Margarita Westaway, he could be forgiven for assuming he had found the right woman. But now that she was over the first shock of seeing her mother, young, fearless, here, the disquiet began to sink in. The question that had beaten her head as she'd hurried up the stairs was how Abel could possibly have seen that photograph and not joined the dots. And now, as Hal stared down at the faded, yellowed picture, the thought recurred, more unsettlingly. For the other Margarita, the real Margarita, the one sitting on the lawn next to Ezra, was fair, like Harding and Abel. Hal's mother was dark, like Hal herself. All her life, Hal had heard people remark on her likeness to her mother, and she had never really been able to see what they were talking about, beyond their obviously similar colouring. But now, looking at the photographic evidence in front of her, her mother at an age so close to her own, now Hal could see it only too clearly. From the suspicious dark eyes, the colour of espresso coffee, to the straight black hair, the hawkish nose, even to the defiant tilt of her mother's chin, Hal saw herself. Here, right in front of her, was concrete evidence of the truth and of the mistake that had been made. How long would it be before Abel or someone else realised that? Restlessly, Hal stood and walked to the window looking out. The day had grown overcast, and far away in the distance she could see a grey mass, flecked with white, rising to meet the sky. It might have been cloud, but Hal thought, though she could not be sure, that it was probably the sea. All of a sudden, she felt a powerful urge to get out, get away, and she found herself gripping at the bars as if she could prise them apart and escape the confines of the little room and the prison she had created for herself with this situation. Because as she shoved the photograph away in her pocket for the second time, Hal realised that the evidence in the picture was only half the issue. The real problem was something far worse. In taking that photo, in asking the questions she had in the way that she had, Hal had crossed a line. She was no longer simply the passive recipient of Mr. Trezick's error, swept up in a mistaken assumption, with no provable wrongdoing on her part. No. In that moment of accepting the photograph, she had begun to actively deceive the Westaways in a way that could be tracked back to her and proven. And the potential result of her deception was no longer a few thousand pounds, but a whole estate stolen from under the noses of Hester Westaway's rightful heirs. Up to this point, Hal thought, she might, at a stretch, have claimed ignorance or confusion. She could have cited Mr. Trezick's letter coming out of the blue, the fact that she had never met her grandparents. She could have painted herself as an innocent bystander caught in a mix-up, a trusting young woman too shy to question the discrepancies in what she had been told. But now, by taking this photograph and failing to mention that the other woman in the picture was her real mother, she had begun something very different. She had begun to commit an active, traceable fraud.
6th of December, 1994. I couldn't sleep last night. I lay awake, my hands over my stomach, trying to press it back to flatness, and I thought about the night it happened. It was late in August, when the days were longer and hotter than I could ever have imagined, and the sky was that fierce Cornish blue. The boys were back from school and university, filling the house with an unaccustomed noise and energy that felt strange after the stifled silence I had grown used to these last few months. My aunt had gone up to London for some reason, and Mrs. Warren had gone into Penzance to see her sister, and without their dark, crow-like presence, the atmosphere felt light and full of happiness. It was Maud who came up to find me in my room where I was reading. She burst in, holding a towel and her bright red swimming costume in one hand and her sunglasses in the other.
"Get a move on, Maggie,"
she said, plucking the book out of my hand and tossing it onto the bed, losing my place, I noticed with a flash of irritation.
"We're going swimming in the lake."
I didn't want to. That's the strange thing to remember. I don't mind pools or the sea, but I've never liked lake swimming. The slimy reeds and the mush at the bottom and the mouldering branches that catch at your feet. But Maud is a hard person to say no to, and at last I let her pull me downstairs to where the boys were waiting, Ezra holding a set of oars. In the crumbling boathouse, Maud untied the rickety flat-bottomed skiff, and we rowed out to the island, the lake water dappled and brown beneath the hull of the boat. Maud tied the boat to a makeshift jetty and we climbed out. It was Maud who went in first, a flash of scarlet against the gold-brown waters as she dived, long and shallow, from the end of the rotting wooden platform.
"Come on, Ed!"
she shouted, and he stood up, grinned at me, then followed her to the water's edge and took a running jump. I wasn't sure if I would go in. I was content to watch the others, laughing and playing in the water, splashing each other and shrieking. But the sun grew hotter and hotter, and at last I stood, shading my eyes, considering.
"Come in!" Abel yelled. "It's glorious!"
I walked to the end of the jetty, feeling the damp wood fraying against my bare toes, and I dipped, just dipped, the tip of my toes in the water, watching with pleasure the scarlet polish I had borrowed from Maud glowing bright beneath the water. And then, almost before I knew what had happened, a hand seized my ankle and I felt a tug, and I stumbled forward to prevent myself from going over backwards. Then I was in, the golden waters closing over my head, the mud swirling up around me.
and it was more beautiful and terrifying than I could ever have imagined. I didn't see who pulled me in, but I felt him beneath the water, his skin against mine, our arms grappling, half fighting. And in that moment when we both surfaced, I felt it. His fingers brushed my breast, making me shiver and gasp in a way that wasn't just the shock of the water. Our eyes met, blue and dark, and he grinned, and my stomach flipped and clenched with a hunger I had never known. I knew then that I loved him, and that I would give him anything, even myself. After we rowed back, we walked up to the house, and we had tea on the lawn, wrapped in towels, and then we stretched out to bask in the sunshine. "Take a photo," Maud said lazily, as she stretched, her tanned limbs honey gold against the faded blue towel. "I want to remember today." He gave a groan, but he stood obediently and went to fetch his camera and set it up. I watched him as he stood behind it, adjusting the focus, fiddling with the lens cap.
"Why so serious?" he said as he looked up, and I realized that I was frowning in concentration, trying to fix his face in my memory. He flashed me that irresistible smile, and I felt my own mouth curve in helpless sympathy.
Later, long after supper, when the sun was going down, Mrs. Warren had gone to bed and the others were playing billiards on the faded green baize, laughing in the way they never did when my aunt was home. Ezra had brought his stereo down from his room, and the tape deck blasted out James, R.E.M. and the Pixies by turns, filling the room with the clash of guitars and drums. I could never play billiards. The cue never did what I wanted, the balls flipping off the cushions with a life of their own. Maud said I wasn't trying, that it was perfectly simple to match up cause and effect and work out where the ball would end up, but it wasn't true. I had some gene missing, I think. Whatever it was that enabled Maud to see that if a ball were hit from this angle, it would ricochet over there, I didn't have. So I left them to it and wandered out onto the lawn in front of the old part of the house. I was sitting, watching the sun beginning to dip towards the horizon, and thinking about how beautiful this place was in spite of it all, when I felt a touch on my shoulder, and I turned and saw him standing there, beautiful and bronzed, his hair falling in his eyes. "Come for a walk with me," he said. I nodded and followed him, across the fields and through sunken paths, down to the sea. And we lay on the warm sand and watched as the sun sank into the waves in a blaze of red and gold. And I didn't say anything because I was so afraid to break this perfect moment. So afraid that he would get up and leave forever, and that everything would be back to normal. But he didn't. He lay next to me, watching the sky in a silence that felt like the breath you take before you say something very important. As the last streak of sun disappeared beneath the horizon, he turned to me, and I thought he was going to speak, but he didn't. Instead, he slipped the strap of my sundress down my shoulder. And I thought, this is it. This is what I have been waiting all my life to feel. This is what those girls at school used to talk about. This is what the songs mean and the poems were written for. This is it. He is it. But the sun has gone now, and it's winter, and I feel very cold.
and I am no longer sure if I was right.
Chapter 19. Hal wasn't sure how long she had been sitting there, staring at the photograph, trying to work out what she should do. But at last she heard very faintly the sound of the clock in the hall downstairs chiming 11, and she stood, stretching out her cramped, chilly limbs. The urge to run back to Brighton and hide from the nightmare she had created was still strong, except that they knew where to find her. Mr. Treswick had her address, and he would come and track her down and start asking questions. And besides, her stomach clenched at the memory of Mr. Smith's awaiting enforcers, her crushed belongings. Hal had never thought of herself as a coward, but she was. She knew that now. She thought of the man's voice, his slow, soft lisp.
Broken teeth, broken bones, sometimes.
And she knew she did not have the